This message comes from OnPoint's sponsor, Indeed. If you're hiring, with Indeed, you can post a job in minutes, set up screener questions, then zero in on your short list of qualified candidates using an online dashboard. Get started at Indeed.com/NPR podcast.
From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. The Vietnam War was a war of terrible passions and drama. It ended that way, too, with the fall of Saigon, capital of the South, 40 years ago. North Vietnamese troops flooding in toward the city. Americans and South Vietnamese desperate to get out. Images of escape and defeat burned in the minds of a generation. This hour on Point, the fall of Saigon and its long resonance 40 years on. You can join us on air or online where this conversation is always on. Do you remember the fall of Saigon? How do you see its meaning now? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at onpointradio. 1973, earlier, President Nixon had announced the Paris Agreement on ending the war and restoring peace in Vietnam. Press conference in January of 73, peace with honor was his rallying cry then. It was not to be. But here's Nixon 2 years before the end.
I have asked for this radio and television time tonight for the purpose of announcing that we today have concluded an agreement to end the war and bring peace with honor in Vietnam and in Southeast Asia.
End of April 1975, 40 years ago, things were going in a very different direction. Here's a radio report.
The government of South Vietnam has surrendered to the Viet Cong. A radio address to the nation, President Nguyen Van Dinh told soldiers to lay down their arms and stop fighting. He called on the Provisional Revolutionary Government to enter into discussions for what he called the turnover ceremony for the administration, both civilian and military. Fighting could be heard around the edges of Saigon as he spoke and after he spoke.
You can hear the chaos right there in that report. On the ground, people clamoring to get out. The famous image of the helicopter on the roof of the U.S. Embassy. It was Dam Phan, an Army officer, lieutenant with the South Vietnamese Central Intelligence Services. This is from the documentary Last Days in Vietnam, which premiered last night on PBS.
I went with my wife to the embassy. A lot of people, they clenched to the top of the wall, but they couldn't get in. There was a sea of people wanting to get out by helicopters. But, they looked up at the helicopters leaving, and I could see their eyes, desperate. Nice.
Chaos, panic, everyone clambering. Here was Michael Nicholson with the Independent Television Network talking about getting out at the embassy of Saigon, April 29th, 1975.
The embassy gates were closed, and we, like the frightened Vietnamese and their families, had to fight and claw our way up. And we did claw, and we did fight. And if it wasn't for one single American Marine, whose name I didn't have the chance or time to discover, we would never have climbed our way to our evacuation. He hauled us up, kicking and punching Vietnamese who were clambering over our bodies.
Back home, there was serious meditation over the meaning of a war that had cost so much. Here, April 29th, 1975, standing in Arlington National Cemetery, is NBC Nightly News commentator then, David Brinkley, talking about what was lost in the Vietnam War.
56,000 lives. Plus about 150,000 seriously wounded, many of whom will never recover. So when some future politician, for some reason, feels the need to drag this country into a war, he might come out here to Arlington and stand maybe right over there somewhere to make his announcement and to tell what he has in mind.
56,000 lives, says Douglas Brinkley there in 1975. Of course, that was just American lives, 3 million plus Vietnamese lives lost. We will hear today from celebrated American war correspondent H.D.S. Greenway, who covered the Vietnam War for years and was there at the fall. And we will hear the perspective of Vietnamese American novelist Viet Thanh Nguyen, who was 4 years old when his family fled Vietnam at the war's end. We want to hear from you as well. 800-423-8255 is our number. 423-8255, 800-423-TALK. Joining me first in the studio is H.D.S. Greenway, David Greenway, who was correspondent in Vietnam for The Washington Post and Time magazine, contributing columnist now for the Boston Globe, the International Herald Tribune, the Global Post. He was one of the last reporters to leave Vietnam 40 years ago. He's author of Foreign Correspondent, a memoir. David Greenway, welcome back to On Point.
Thank you.
Would you be good enough to put us in the streets of Saigon in those very last days of the war before the fall?
Well, the last days, there was a sense of unease that had been going on all month began to be much more panicky. People were visibly tired and weeping in the street, and mothers would offer their daughters in marriage to any American walking by to help try to get
take
them
her
out.
Get her out. Yeah,
yeah. One guy I knew bought poison for his family, but in the end he couldn't do it, so he sent the children away to live with relatives who hadn't worked with Americans,
hoping that that link wouldn't be discovered when the North Vietnamese came.
Exactly. And there was another guy I remember who decided to stay. And he said, perhaps it's better you take away all your war profiteers, your secret policemen and interrogators. We Vietnamese make very bad exiles. We're not as bad as the Russians, who cry even more than we do because of homesickness. But we're not like the Chinese, who can get along and prosper anywhere. So it showed a terrible fear of what was going to happen.
We're going to hear the Vietnamese American perspective from Viet Thanh Nguyen in just a few minutes here. But David, at this point, 40 years later, we'll have many, many, many listeners who were not born and wouldn't be born for years when Saigon fell.
Yes.
Remind us of the great project that was ending with the fall of Saigon. And I guess it goes all the way from the American War or what the Vietnamese call the American War, maybe to the whole project of Western colonial presence in Asia.
Well, it really started in 1945. President Roosevelt didn't want the French to come back.
As imperial colonial masters in Vietnam.
Exactly, exactly.
They'd been away while the Japanese were in charge,
yes,
shall we say.
And but Roosevelt was dead, and the Truman administration felt that it was more important to get along with France. They were worried about communism in Europe, and so we made the decision to back the French.
Mm-hmm.
And so we equipped and backed the French and urged them to fight on until the Battle of Dien Bien Phu in 1954. And then they finally left completely in 1956. And then we took over as tutors of the Republic of South Vietnam. But more and more we took over the war ourselves, so that we were doing most of the fighting. So when the end came, it was 30 years of backing up this enterprise. We got into it because we wanted to turn back communism. But from my point of view, I don't think we understood that for the Vietnamese, the anti-colonial struggle was more important than communism.
Of course, the country was divided north and south, the communists in the north and the American allies in the south. In 1975, most U.S. troops gone.
The most American troops, the last combat troops had left in 73.
And so when the end came, we heard at this point Richard Nixon out as after the Watergate scandal. Maybe the North Vietnamese, emboldened by that documentary we referred to earlier, saying, the North Vietnamese were afraid Nixon would come back with an air campaign if they advanced too much. Gerald Ford, this was earlier in mid-April 1975, that here he was appealing to Congress to help with this closing down of the whole thing in South Vietnam with the withdrawal. President Ford.
There are tens of thousands of South Vietnamese employees of the United States government, of news agencies, of contractors and businesses for many years, whose lives, with their dependents, are in very grave peril. I am therefore asking the Congress to appropriate without delay $722 million for emergency military assistance for South Vietnam.
There was essentially no way that was going to be signed off on from the documentary Last Days in Vietnam. Here's former Secretary of State Henry Kissinger saying that was already clear.
We knew we were not going to get the $722 million. By that time, it made no big difference. But President Ford said he owed it to Vietnam to make a request.
He owed it to Vietnam to make the request. It didn't go through. It was a chaotic evacuation. David Greenway was there. David, now let's go right to the last day or couple of days. What did you see going on? What about the evacuation itself? Yourself, Americans, Vietnamese, how was it unfolding?
Well, we had hoped that we'd be able to get out by fixed-wing aircraft, and some were able to do that. But early that morning before dawn, we could hear shells landing in the city. And a couple of reporters had these little radios you could buy for $20 in Hong Kong. Mm-hmm. And we could listen to the frequency of the embassy. So we heard the Marines at Thon Son Nhut Airport saying they were under shell fire, that two Americans had been killed. Turned out to be the last two of the war. So we knew pretty much that it would have to be a chaotic evacuation by helicopter.
The time to hesitate is through. No time to wallow in the mire. Try now, we can only lose. And our love become a funeral pyre. Come on, baby, light my fire. Come on, baby, light my fire. Try to set the night on.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about the fall of Saigon 40 years ago this week, today and tomorrow, and the end and echoes of the Vietnam War. You can join us this hour. Were you there in the last days before the fall of Saigon? Do you remember Walter Cronkite telling the story on the evening news, the country taking on board what was happening? Vietnamese Americans, how do you see the war now, its end, its meaning, the American role, your story? It was days of panic and chaos. Here again, the sound of helicopters ferrying people out of Saigon to U.S. ships offshore, April 29th, 1975. Here, the sound of crowds of Vietnamese trying to get into the U.S. Embassy on the same day, April 29th, 1975. And here, NBC's George Lewis reporting from a ship as Vietnamese pilots started trying to land on it, just coming out on their own accord.
Aboard the U.S. carriers waiting off the coast in the South China Sea, helicopters were arriving that did not belong to any ship of the fleet. South Vietnamese pilots had commandeered them and had flown themselves and their families out from right under the noses of the Communist Army. They joined the ranks of refugees aboard, but there was no room for their machines on deck, and so millions of dollars worth of helicopters were simply pushed overboard.
H.G.S. Greenway, author of Foreign Correspondent, covered Vietnam for years, the war, for Time magazine, for the Washington Post. He was there in those last days, the last day. He's with us in the studio. We'll be joined in just a moment by Vietnamese-American novelist Viet Thanh Nguyen. Jack is calling from Bloomington, Illinois, no less. Hi, Jack. You're on the air. Thank you for calling. What's your story?
Hi, Tom. Well, my ship was in the harbor, the USS Milwaukee, and my remembrance, there were three aircraft carriers and about 50 ships that were all stationed there. And our ship got underway and started moving, and then the captain put us into emergency flight ops for our large helicopter deck on the back end of the ship. And we got the fork trucks up there, and our orders were to push any helicopters off the ship into the drink once all personnel and people got off of them. So we waited for about 45 minutes. Again, we were on a tanker with 9 million gallons of fuel on board, and I think they decided at the last minute to shut them over to the carriers instead of any ship that's got a helicopter deck.
And remind people who just might not get it why you would have been shoving helicopters off the deck?
Because there was more coming.
Yeah. And no room for them. Jack, what were your feelings on that day? Do you remember standing there as a young military member?
Yes, I do. I remember that the day before President Johnson died, the day before Nixon made the announcement, and I talked to my buddies on the ship, and I said, I wonder if Nixon or staff got word to Lyndon Johnson before he died, but he was probably in bad shape if he was dying. So I don't know if he ever knew that Nixon was going to end the war that day or not, but all of us were relieved. It was chaos. We were just a small piece of the pie being on the ship. All of the people on land naturally went through much more than the guys on the ships did in the harbor naturally.
Jack, thank you so much for your call. David Greenway, there was the famous moment where a big tree was cut down in the embassy lawn so choppers could come in, the kind of sign. And then I think you saw some of those choppers being pushed off the...
I did, yes. But the tree was interesting because it would have blocked helicopters coming into the courtyard of the embassy. Mm-hmm. And the American ambassador, Graham Martin, forbade that anyone cut the tree down for days and days and days.
Or even talk about evacuating or defeat.
Exactly. To the last moment, he thought some deal could be worked out. Maybe the bottom half or the bottom third of the country could be independent. Self-delusion. Mm-hmm. But when I arrived at the embassy, these Marines were furiously cutting down this tree with chainsaws. So that was the sign for us that this was the end.
There had been so much drama around Vietnam. Did you have the sense of the end of an era standing there in that crazy day?
Oh, very much so. I think that a lot of us as we were waiting for these helicopters felt a terrible sense of shame that this was ending in such chaos and disorder, and 30 years of American effort was going down the drain in such a terrible manner. And we had been trying to get our own employees out for weeks before that.
No small feat.
No small feat, but the point is there were going to be hundreds and hundreds of Vietnamese, thousands who would be seen as corrupted by the North Vietnamese and would have to go to re-education camp.
Or take to the seas in little boats.
Well, exactly.
You and yes. I were in Southeast Asia after that. I, for years, saw them coming onto many other shores around the region at great risk of their lives. Many, of course, ended up in the United States and elsewhere. Joseph in New Orleans. Joseph, thank you for calling. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi. What's your story, Joseph?
Hi, Tom. I was eight at the time of the fall of Saigon. And at that time, my mother told me that I would to go to the United States first, and then they would join me later.
Joseph, was your family Vietnamese, I take it? South Vietnamese?
Yes. My mother was Vietnamese, and my father was also Vietnamese, and he was an officer in the military. And then after the war, he was sent to the Vietnamese re-education camp for over 6 years.
Wow.
And I finally was able to reunite with them in 1991 after I left.
That is a long time, Joseph.
Yes. And when I was serving in the U.S. House from 2009 and 2011, one of the issues that I was working on with other members of Congress was trying to address the issue of post-traumatic syndrome for the many families and officers who served who was in prison in the Vietnamese re-education camp.
I'm speaking with former Congressman Joseph Gao of Louisiana, Republican there. You served from, 2009 to 11? Congressman Gao, sorry, let me make that clear.
Yes, that's correct. I served from 2009 to 2011. Mm-hmm. And again, the fall of Saigon has much more significant impact than simply that Vietnam lost the war.
Mm-hmm.
You're talking about, after the war, hundreds of thousands of families were eventually sent to what they call the new economic zone. They were displaced, a lot of them died of malaria, of sickness in the jungle, so on and so forth.
Very brutal circumstances.
Correct. And then a lot of military officers, like my father, you're talking about hundreds of thousands of former military officers were sent to re-education camps, and there a lot of them died of starvation. They experienced all the torture. You're talking about killing, so on and so forth. And at the same time, you have people like my mother who had to take care of at that time, my five sisters by herself. And then right after the war, there was a period of starvation from 76 to 80, where people basically had nothing to eat. So again, the issue of the fall of Saigon has a much greater impact than simply the fact that the communists took over all of Vietnam. The events after the war was just absolutely horrible.
Deep suffering, widely spread. Congressman Joseph Gao in New Orleans, I appreciate you calling very much. We've all been watching a lot about this, seeing the PBS documentary. There, our home station, WBUR, also has put together a very interesting piece on this called Saigon, The Final Hours. You can see it at WBUR.org. I want to look at exactly that bigger picture. David Greenway, stand by with me in the studio. With us now from Los Angeles is Vietnam-born, Vietnamese-American novelist Viet Thanh Nguyen, author of the new novel The Sympathizer, which begins essentially with the fall of Saigon. Washington Post calls it extraordinary. The New York Times, remarkable. Viet Thanh Nguyen is Associate Professor of English and American Studies and Ethnicity at the University of Southern California. He was just 4 years old when his family fled South Vietnam in 1975. You can read an excerpt of his book at our website, onpointradio.org. Viet Thanh Nguyen, thank you very much for being with us today.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for having me.
We have invited you, and we have invited you anytime, but especially at the 40th anniversary of the fall of Saigon, to be fully reminded that this is much more than just an American story. As Congressman Gao from New Orleans just reminded us, there was tremendous drama in Vietnam itself, the Vietnamese at the heart of that, and they paid the price in suffering for years after the fall of Saigon. How do you see the way Americans remember the end of this war, the image of the top of the embassy, the movie depictions of the war all these years later?
Well, I think generally the way that Americans have chosen to remember their Vietnam War is a war about Americans. The American perception is that this war was really something that cost a lot of American lives. Over 58,000 American soldiers died there. And if you read the journalistic accounts, the soldier stories, novels, watch a lot of American movies, what's remarkable is that they focus very much on this being something that involved Americans or became something that was like a civil war in the American soul. And the Vietnamese people tended to function as extras or faceless people in most of these types of accounts, especially in Hollywood. But of course, as Congressman Cao said, the war extracted a huge cost on the Vietnamese population of all sides. He talked a lot about the southern Vietnamese and so on. But the war killed up to 3 million Vietnamese people. And that's something that I think many Americans have forgotten, that this was really a war that was tremendously devastating for all sides in this Vietnamese conflict.
David Greenway, for Americans who may have lived through the Iraq War, the Afghanistan War, maybe even the Gulf War, but maybe not, younger Americans, I'm not sure fully take on board how much drama was around the Vietnam War. These have been fairly low-drama wars by comparison. Well, in Vietnam, plenty of drama. In Iraq and Afghanistan, plenty of drama, but at home.
Well, there was no draft for Iraq and Afghanistan. Mm-hmm. And it was the draft that really split this country because people were going, all-volunteer army, you don't have to worry about that. But when you're made to go and you don't want to, that's bad for morale. And it split the country, I think, more than anything since the Civil War.
For a decade, the music, the protests in the streets, the culture, I find it not easy to convey how consumed with debate over this war the United States was.
I have one memory of that day 40 years ago that Mr. Nguyen might find interesting. Mm-hmm. I had to get out of the embassy through this terrible crowd of panicked people to file the fall of Saigon for the Washington Post.
The story.
And I, the only way I could file it was from my best friend, Phan Xuan An, who I'd known at Time Magazine, and he let me use the Time Telex, even though I was working for a rival paper.
This is pre-internet, ladies and gentlemen. This you had to have a telex,
yes,
kind
to
of
have a
very
telex.
Cumbersome, clunky old pound, pound, pound way.
And he was by far my best Vietnamese friend. We'd worked together as colleagues. And I found out after the fall of Saigon that he'd been an agent for the North Vietnamese during the entire time and during the French War as well.
Viet Thanh Nguyen, the protagonist in your novel, has a somewhat similar role. This is a deep mole, a spy within the South Vietnamese, and later comes to America as well. David Greenway lived this reality, though he didn't know it at the time. How did you choose to tell the story of all this through the story of a mole, a spy, Viet?
Well, I'd certainly heard of the story of Pham Xuan An that David talked about. And when I wanted to write this novel, I thought a spy story would be great because here would be a person who would get to be involved in all the historical moments and be able to see things from both sides. And that was really the critical idea for me. This war was a war that was fought passionately by people of different factions and beliefs, but all of them, or most of them, really believed they were doing the right thing. And they saw things from their point of view exclusively. And I didn't want to write a novel that would simply repeat that kind of a story. I wanted to have a character who was capable of sympathizing with all the different sides in the conflict. And the reason why that was important was because for me, what made this war a tragedy was not that it was a conflict between right and wrong, but that it was a conflict between right and right. That is, all the different sides had legitimate reasons for believing that they were fighting for the right cause. And that's what leads to tragedy, or in the case of my book, tragic comedy.
Cam in Omaha, Nebraska. Thank you for calling, Cam. You're on the air.
Yeah. My name is Cam. I was 12 years old when this happened. I was watching from the balcony of our home.
You were Vietnamese in Saigon, Cam.
I'm South Vietnamese. I'm living in the U.S. right now.
Yes, yes.
So I was 12 years old when I saw the Soviet-built T-54 tank rolling through the street of Saigon. It was pretty chaotic. Just half an hour prior to that, I saw a South Vietnamese soldier in the GMC trucks stopping their truck on the bridge near my home, jumping on their uniform, M16 rifle, and all the gears they have. They run like madmen, try to escape the Viet Cong. So, and about an hour later, I saw the Soviet T-54 tank rolling through the bridge. So it was quite a scene to watch.
How did you and your family, if it was all of you, get out of Vietnam, Cam?
Oh, I stayed behind for 4 years. The majority of my family members left through a Korean ship that happened to leave around, I think, April 26 or April 27, a few days prior. So they were leaving together with the Korean ship.
And all these years later, how do you look back on the end of the war? Does it look inevitable? Does it look like betrayal?
40 years go by fast, I can tell you that now. I have a lot of gray hair now. I moved to Canada in 1979 and then went to school in there, and then now I settled in the U.S.
Lives sent in a million directions at the end of the Vietnam War. Cam, in Omaha, thank you for calling. Edwin Starr's War from 1970. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. Hi, everybody. Tom here. I'm glad you're joining us for this On Point podcast. Before we get back to the show, I'd like to tell you about another podcast you might enjoy, too, Dear Sugar Radio. Join hosts Cheryl Strayed and Steve Almond as they field questions about love, sex, work, guilt, money, you name it. That's Dear Sugar Radio. You can find it at wbur.org/Dear Sugar or subscribe on iTunes. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about the fall of Saigon in Vietnam 40 years ago this week, today and tomorrow, and the end of echoes of the Vietnam War. Viet Thanh Nguyen is with us, novelist, author of the new novel, The Sympathizer, a novel. You can read an excerpt at our website, onpointradio.org. Vietnamese-American, he was just 4 years old when his family fled, some of them, not all, in 1975. He's now at University of Southern California. HDS David Greenway is with us as well, author, foreign correspondent, a memoir, covered the Vietnam War for Time Magazine and the Washington Post, was there on that last day as it bled over the 29th into the 30th, and finally all the choppers headed out and the end. David, we had lots of response from our listeners online. Linda writes on Facebook, Vietnam was my generation's war. I still get tears in my eyes to think of all that happened. I hope that at some future time there will be a generation who doesn't have its own war. That we haven't seen yet. Ari writes, considering that the nation and Pentagon forgot everything we learned about insurgency theory in Vietnam, I say Vietnam doesn't resonate enough. Ari writes, we forgot that you can't send only a military to war. We forgot or neglected to learn all kinds of things in Vietnam. Listener says, regardless of what we won or lost, a lot of brave soldiers served, got wounded, and died. But this is treated practically as a non-event now. Sad. Well, maybe true, but it's not a non-event. I was just hearing today from a person who had been talking with those working with homeless Americans about the enormous numbers of Vietnam War vets that remain among our homeless population. Ray writes to us from Vermont, the whole affair should be a warning as to the limits of the ability of a power to combat an irregular foe which has support or at least sympathies or the acquiescence of the local population. This very relevant still to the United States today. Viet Thanh Nguyen, tell us the story of you and your family and how it came to be that some of you got out, some of you did not.
Well, my family were originally refugees in 1954 when the country was divided in two, and my parents were living in a small northern village, and they came south.
They were devout Catholics, and that put them at some risk.
Yes, 800,000 Catholics left because the CIA led them to believe that communists would persecute them. And my father left behind his entire family, wouldn't see them again for 40 years. My mother came with her family, settled in the south in a small town called Ban Mit Thuot, which had the distinction of being the first town overrun in the 1975 invasion. So this
big
is actually a
coffee-producing center there.
It's still a big coffee-producing center. So if you drink U-Ban coffee, things like that, you'll probably have Vietnamese coffee beans in there. But my father was actually in Saigon at the time. My mother was home with my brother, myself, and my adopted sister. She had to make a life-and-death decision without being able to communicate with my dad. She decided to leave my adopted sister behind to take care of the home and family business because she believed, like many other Vietnamese people, that this wasn't the end. The war had gone back and forth for a very long time, so she thought it was going to be a temporary getaway. So she took my brother and I to the seaside town of Nha Trang, which was 120 miles away. She walked all the way, downhill at least, got on a refugee barge and managed to make our way to Saigon, where we reconnected with my father. And then in April, we had to flee again on another boat to Guam.
A long, long story and many, many years of separation there. Your father would start a grocery in the United States, eventually end up supporting a lot of those in Vietnam. What about the feelings between those who left and those who stayed? How did that play out over the years?
I think it was very tense because my family in Vietnam for many years, because the country was very poor, really needed assistance just to live. And that was what my parents were doing, sending money back as remittances. And many, many people in the Vietnamese diaspora were doing exactly the same thing. So there was a real relationship of dependency and potentially envy, you know, because the people in Vietnam didn't really know what was happening with the overseas Vietnamese people, didn't see the struggles that they were enduring as refugees and as immigrants in many foreign countries. They just saw the overseas Vietnamese people as being lucky and as being rich because they were in the West. Or if they happened to be communist Vietnamese, they thought of overseas Vietnamese people as being traitors and puppets who had served the Americans and the French. So when the overseas Vietnamese started to return to Vietnam, starting in about, you know, the early 1990s and in increasing numbers up until the present day, it was a very fraught encounter oftentimes. There was certainly homecoming and welcoming and tears and all of that. But underneath all of that, there was jealousy and envy and resentment and unanswered questions and fraught emotional relationships. And the relationship between the Vietnamese people remains sort of tense. A lot of Americans who go back to Vietnam are amazed at the fact that the Vietnamese generally welcome them with open arms and have put the past behind them, at least in terms of Americans. But the Vietnamese in Vietnam and the Vietnamese overseas haven't been able to put that history to rest.
You can see Saigon, The Final Hours. You can link to it at our website, onpointradio.org, or at wbur.org. Patty in Deerfield Beach, Florida. Patty, thank you for calling. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Thank you. Mm-hmm. What I was recalling was after having been down in Washington, D.C. with my husband and a two-year-old and four-year-old as a protest against the war and having to run away from tear gas with our children, I recall the joy when the war was over, taking the kids, with going together with many friends from an alternative school and taking the kids to New York City where the celebration to end the war, because the war had ended, was so joyous, with Phil Oak singing and I think Joan Baez singing and people dancing and just a wonderful, wonderful spirit that finally we were out of a war. I wish we were out of all wars now.
Patty, you clearly recall the joy of that day, the war ending, to be in Central Park in New York was joyful. Mm-hmm. What did you think then, or what do you think now about the suffering that we're hearing of the Vietnamese who were left behind? It was not a joyful moment for many of them.
I think they didn't have a very joyful time with foreign invaders in their country either. Mm-hmm. And I know there were certainly differences and people coming from many different angles and the thousands of young Americans that got killed too.
Yeah.
You know, it's not a good part of our history, and the sad thing is that so much of the time since then we've been at war as well.
True,
and
this
I'm
is very
proud
true.
To say that my children and grandchildren and husband and I still have protested against the current wars.
There have been plenty. Patty, I appreciate your call. Janice in Greenville, South Carolina. Janice, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. I just wanted to share some of the insights that I had. My ex-husband, when he came back from Vietnam, we were together. He was 19 years old. And when he left Vietnam, they told them not to wear their uniforms, to travel in civilian clothes because there was so much opposition to the war. So he didn't come back as a hero. He came back afraid to tell anybody he had fought in the Vietnam War. Mm-hmm. His best friend, who was a medic, was killed on the battlefield, and he had to carry him out. He was afraid to leave him. And those things had such far-reaching and tragic effects on his life. As a Marine, he was sprayed with Agent Orange and wound up with Hodgkin's lymphoma in later life. So there were so many things that people go through and continue to go through, and their families suffer. And the fall of Vietnam came in 1975, I'll never forget. He was watching TV, and he put his head in his hand and just sobbed and said that it was all for nothing.
Janice, I'm sorry for that memory, but I appreciate your call very much. Your husband, who suffered from the effects of Agent Orange later, 12 million gallons of that sprayed by the U.S. over 10% of South Vietnam in the decade ending 1971. 2 to 4 million Vietnamese exposed, more than 2 million U.S. service members exposed. David Greenway, Viet Thanh Nguyen, I want to think about lessons from, and we can look at that day endlessly. The drama of it was so high, but it ended a large engagement, a large and deeply divisive war. David, when you look back on all of that now, what lessons do you draw, and has the country drawn them? Is it evident that we all imagined we would draw deep, profound, unending lessons from the Vietnam War. Did we?
Well, I remember talking to General Dempsey in Baghdad 10 years ago. He's now chairman of the Joint Chiefs, but then he was in charge of training the Iraqi army. And he and his staff told me that you can train and equip an army, but you can't motivate it. That's up to the Iraqis themselves.
And at that time in Baghdad, he's talking about the Iraqi army.
The Iraqi army, which again collapsed much the way the South Vietnamese army
in
did.
In the face of Islamic State onslaught.
And I think that to try to instill American values by means of intervention and military occupation just doesn't work out and has not served us well.
What does that mean? Does it mean stay home? Because Americans are exhorted to go abroad and go to war with, as our callers are pointing out, one after another with notable frequency.
Well, I think that if it's deemed necessary that the nation go to war, that we have to be very careful about how we do it. I think the best example was George Herbert Walker Bush in the first Gulf War, where we got in and got out, accomplished the mission.
Iraq had invaded Kuwait, go in, boot them out of Kuwait, yeah, and be done.
Yes.
In a matter of 30, 40 days.
Yes, and not spend 10 years trying to occupy Iraq.
Viet Thanh Nguyen, I'm curious, when you think of lessons of the fall of Saigon, the end of the war, the entire war, as a Vietnamese American, what lessons stand up to you? They might be quite different.
Well, I think that there's been a failure to imagine creatively. And, you know, as David said, we haven't learned the conventional military lessons. We haven't learned the conventional strategic lessons about why we should get involved in foreign countries. And I think that means that we haven't thought enough about how it is that we could actually do things differently if we want to encourage democracy or if we want to help people think better of America. Maybe we should try peaceful means instead of military means or instead of inserting ourselves into foreign countries. Because what happened in Vietnam was the United States went in, told the Vietnamese how to fight the war in a particular way, boosted the economy with enormous amounts of money. And what that ultimately led to was the corruption of South Vietnam and the corruption of the military, corruption of the political leadership, and the terrible end of the war. And that's, I think, something similar happened in Iraq and Afghanistan. Then lastly, as a Vietnamese person who's a refugee and came to the United States, I think that the United States has not learned a fundamental lesson, which is that you cannot look at people in other places from an American-centric point of view. That is partially what brought the U.S. to Vietnam, ignoring Vietnamese viewpoints and imposing American ones. And again, I think that's exactly what we're doing in Iraq and Afghanistan today.
When you go back to Vietnam, you have gone back. What do you see? How do you feel?
Oh, I feel tormented, you know, because many of my relatives are still there and many of them are still poor. So it's an emotionally difficult thing for me. And then I also see, you know, I'm also very sad because this horrible war was fought. So many people died. And in the end, we ended up with a Vietnam that is exactly something the Americans would have loved, which is a Vietnam that has completely turned itself over to capitalism and has turning into an American strategic ally in the conflict with China. And I think what would have happened if the United States had simply left Vietnam alone and spared all the cost of blood and treasure, we might have ended up with exactly the same situation, but without all those lost lives.
Without all that loss. David, take us to that last day again. Viet was 4 years old. You were fully in the midst of a career as a journalist.
I was almost 40.
Yeah. And you, when did you get on the chopper that took you out? Where was that? What did you see as you left? What were you thinking?
Well, I left around dusk, and as the helicopter—
It would be on the 29th. It would be the next morning before the last choppers went out, I guess.
And I could see ammunition dumps blowing up to the north.
Were the North Vietnamese troops in the city or on the outskirts?
On the outskirts at some distance, but there were explosions at that time going off. I could see the crowds of people milling through the streets of Saigon trying to get onto boats. And this vivid impression of, as the helicopter landed on the Navy ships, of these hundreds and hundreds of little boats, overcrowded boats.
Bobbing around
in the ocean as if they were the flotsam and jetsam of some terrible shipwreck, which in one sense they were.
Yes.
And I think I can, in my notebook, I had jotted down that poem by James Russell Lowell that's above the graves of the British killed at Concord.
From the Revolutionary War,
he wrote, "They came 3,000 miles and died to keep the past upon the throne."
And there he was talking about redcoats resisting the American Revolution.
Yeah.
Your thought then?
I say, my goodness, we may have been the redcoats.
10,000 miles instead of three to Vietnam.
10,000 miles instead of three, yeah.
The past did not stay upon its throne. I mean, the colonial era ended.
Exactly. And I remember Raja Ratnam, the prime minister, the foreign minister of Singapore, a great friend of the United States, said that the fall of Saigon marked the true the end of the colonial era in Southeast Asia, the effective and symbolic end of four centuries of Western political and military intervention in the region. And this is coming from a friend of the United States.
Viet Thanh Nguyen, you remind us that in your Vietnamese-American circles, this is called Black April, I guess, for the sorrow of the suffering that came with the end of the war.
Absolutely. It's a very important anniversary for many of the southern Vietnamese in the United States. And for them, their history, the way they look back on the war, is that they lost their country. They lost many family members. They lost property and health and peace of mind. And so it's important for them to commemorate this event from a Vietnamese point of view because they feel they've been overlooked on the American side, and it is a dark time for them.
Will they go back? Do they go back? Repatriate? Or are most Vietnamese American forever now?
They're Vietnamese Americans. They're proud to be Americans, but many of them choose to go back. Either, you know, people from that generation or even people of my generation, they go back because they miss their country or they have relatives. Or for the younger generation, they see economic and cultural opportunities in a capitalist Vietnam that many of them can't find here.
40 years later, what an irony. Viet Thanh Nguyen, author of The Sympathizer, thank you so much for being with us from L.A. today.
Thanks for having me.
And HDS, David Greenway, author of Foreign Correspondent. David, thank you, as always.
Thank you.
Smokey Robinson and the Miracles, the track of my tears. I'm Tom Ashbrook. Thanks for joining us. This is On Point.